This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to listen in today. You know, I have two special guests joining me today, both first-time guests. Joining me on the second part of today's program will be Mr. Tom Pachauri. Tom is the publisher and editor of World Affairs Monthly. And Tom is going to make a prediction that you won't want to miss about the economic and financial future of the United States, as well as the world. And he will be joining me on the third and fourth segments of today's program. Joining me momentarily will be Dr. Robert J. Gordon. Dr. Gordon is the New York Times best-selling author of The Rise and Fall of American Growth. And we'll talk to Dr. Gordon about what he calls his special century, the special century of innovation. He believes that innovation cannot be repeated, and he'll tell us what that means moving ahead for the economy, in his opinion. And as I said, he'll be joining me momentarily. We do have some resources available here for our listeners. Coming up on June the 16th, we will have our Social Security Maximization free dinner seminar that will be held at Stonewater Country Club, Stonewater Country Clubs on Kalamazoo Avenue Southeast. That's out in Caledonia Township. We'll also have the same program on June 30 at Boulder Creek Golf Club. Those are both Thursdays. Both meetings begin at 6 o'clock and conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. You can get more information by visiting socialsecuritydinner.com. And we also have our new retirement rules class that costs just $49. That is a 9 o'clock to 2:30 class held on a Saturday. Our next class will be held on Saturday, June the 25th. That will be held at the East Beltline campus of Western Michigan University. If you'd like to get more information or register, you can visit newretirementrules.com. And at the class, we talk about what effect the money printing or quantitative easing that's taken place will have moving ahead. And, you know, money printing is nothing new. As I was traveling this past week, I was reading the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin, which is a very interesting read. And Ben, way back in the 1700s, 1730s, I believe it was, anonymously published a pamphlet on money printing, and it was titled The Nature and Necessity of a Paper Currency. Now, I would urge you to go check it out, but in short, Ben chronicles in his autobiography how the money supply grew, and I'll read you just a bit from this. He said he obtained the printing of the Newcastle paper money, another profitable job. Ben was a printer, so he liked money printing in the sense that he got the job when it came to printing paper currency. But here's what he said. I now think there are limits beyond which the quantity may be hurtful. And that's on page 50 in his autobiography. Well, we've printed collectively, the Federal Reserve has printed over $5 trillion in new money. And they've done that since the financial crisis. And to use the words of Benjamin Franklin, we believe that at this point we have reached a limit beyond which the quantity may be hurtful, and there will be some inevitable consequences. We talk about these at the new retirement rules class. Again, I would urge you to attend if you've not yet attended, or go get more information at the website, newretirementrules.com. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Robert Gordon. Mr. Gordon is a macroeconomist with a particular interest in unemployment, inflation, and both the long-run and cyclical aspects of labor productivity. He's the author of a textbook in intermediate macroeconomics, which is now in its 12th edition, and he is the best-selling author of his most recent book, The Rise and Fall of American Growth, The U.S. Standard of Living Since the Civil War. And Dr. Gordon, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
So, Robert, talk about the premise of your book, The Rise and Fall of American Growth.
Well, we have a history of American growth that is not at all even, is not at all steady. We had a remarkable transformation in the way everyone lived from 1870 to 1970, something I call the special century. that never had happened before and cannot happen since. It involved the invention of electricity, the invention of the internal combustion engine, the networking of the house. Think of the house. In 1870, it was isolated without any connections to the rest of the world. By 1940, almost every house in urban America was connected with electricity, gas, telephone, running water, and sewage removal. That was a huge change. Back in the 1870s and 1880s, to bring water into the housewife, then almost always it was the woman of the couple, would have to carry the water inside in pails. And all the water used for baths and other purposes had to be carried out. The speed of transportation until 1830 was limited to that of the horse or the sail, and by 1958 we had the Boeing 707 speeding us along as we do now at 80% of the speed of sound. We had a revolution in temperature control. Instead of being too hot or too cold, now with central heating and air conditioning we can expect to have an even year-round temperature inside. So all of these things were happening simultaneously at a very fast pace and incomparably altered the way that Americans lived. Since 1970, we've had a big revolution, the digital revolution, with computers and communications and mobile phones, but they've affected a smaller fraction of people's lives than the great inventions of the special century I referred to earlier. And we now face a future in which innovation is becoming even less, while being evident everywhere, invention is less important. The benefits we get from social networks on our smartphones cannot be compared with the liberation of the housewife from the invention of appliances and the arrival of clean running water.
So, Dr. Gordon, talk about the just comparing the digital revolution that you spoke of since 1970 and then the century, I think you called it the special century, from 1870 to 1970. Talk about the difference in economic impact.
Well, the when we think of the basic human needs of food, clothing, and shelter, all of them were changed much more in the special century before 1970. About food, we had a revolution through the invention of processed food. Back in 1870, the diet was extremely monotonous, made up mainly of corn and pork. And in the late 19th century, we began to have the inventions of everything from Coca-Cola to Jell-O that we take for granted today. Clothing used to be made by the housewife for herself and her daughters, and purchased clothing was mainly for men and boys and shoes. And so that revolution occurred. The way people bought things shifted from the rural general store to the department store for clothing and to the supermarket for food. That had all largely taken place, that transition, by World War II. The same is true of housing, as I mentioned before, was networked during the 50 to 70 years before 1940. So looking at food, clothing, and shelter, the basic human needs, they were unalterably changed during the special century. And when we look at today's kitchens, they're really not that different than they were 50 or 60 years ago, except for the addition of the microwave oven.
So when Dr. Gordon, when you look ahead, and there's, you know, we have slow growth in the economy, what's your forecast economically speaking? Is this lack of significant innovation going to continue to be a drag on the economy?
I think we have to distinguish between the lack of innovation. I'm not saying that there's a lack of innovation or that it's stopped. It's just that it's less important in terms of fulfilling basic human needs. The real progress of the computer revolution in changing the way people worked took place between 1980 and 2005 with the invention of the personal computer, spreadsheet and word processing software that replaced the typewriter and the calculating machine, and then the arrival of free information and e-commerce on the World Wide Web. Those transitions, after all, the elimination of the typewriter had largely been achieved before the web was even introduced in 1995 through the ubiquity of the personal computer. So in my view, we've been standing still for most of the last 10 years. We reached, by 2005, pretty much the limit of what the digital revolution would do to the way that we transact business in offices and all sorts of other types of human life. When you go to the supermarket, when you check in with your doctor or your dentist or veterinarian, they're using software and computer screens that are very much like they did 10 years earlier. So in my view, we're slowing down in terms of the impact of innovation, even though people are frenetically trying to continue to invent things.
Well, our guest today is Dr. Robert Gordon. He is the best-selling author of the book, The Rise and Fall of American Growth, The U.S. Standard of Living Since the Civil War. I'll continue my conversation with Dr. Gordon when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am Dennis Tubergen, your host. Glad you decided to listen in today. I'll get right back to my conversation with Dr. Robert Gordon. But before I do, let me remind you that if you're not yet a subscriber to my Portfolio Watch newsletter, it's easy to become a subscriber and the subscription is free. All you need to do to sign up for your free subscription is visit the website yourportfoliowatch.com. That's your, Y-O-U-R, portfoliowatch.com. And when you sign up, we will put you on our distribution list, and every Monday at 5 p.m., just after the market closes, you'll get my weekly market and economic commentary. Again, the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm pleased to have joining me on today's Everything Financial Radio program, Dr. Robert J. Gordon. He is the best-selling author of The Rise and Fall of American Growth, The U.S. Standard of Living Since the Civil War. And Dr. Gordon, in the last segment, we talked about the special century, the digital revolution that's taken place, and the computer revolution. What about future innovation? What lies ahead, maybe just over the horizon, that could be the next big thing as far as innovation is concerned?
Well, we have a number of different areas. Let me just mention a few of them, including medical care, robots, artificial intelligence, and self-driving cars and trucks. Medical care, we continue to see very steady, slow progress. We've made a lot of progress in things like hip and knee surgery that are much more, much less invasive and much more reliable than they used to be. But we have some big difficulties in the United States with the delivery of medical care. We've just learned that the mortality rate, which has historically gone down every year, actually increased in 2015. We have tremendous inequality of life expectancy. If you're in the top 10% of the income distribution and you're a male, you can expect to live to be 87 years old. If you're in the bottom 10% of the income distribution, you can expect to live to be only 73 years old. That's a 14-year difference, and a lot of that is both the delivery of medical care, but also personal habits and addiction and all the other problems that the medical care system finds it so difficult to overcome. We have very gradual spread of robots. They are still largely in manufacturing. A few of them are in wholesale warehouses. Robots go back 50 years, and as long ago as 20 years, we saw them that they'd pretty much taken over welding bodies and operating the paint shop of automobile factories. But the progress of robots has been very slow in the service sector. We don't see robots stocking the shelves in our supermarkets. We still see humans doing that, as well as serving in restaurants and operating in various types of retail services. Artificial intelligence is one where we see the most progress. We've had the use of computers and data analysis has transformed the way law firms work and discover precedents of old cases. We've had progress in voice recognition, language translation. We're beginning to get robots helping in elementary schools with computers helping with teaching, with personal financial advice. So of all these different innovations, I think we're making the most progress, albeit very incremental and gradually, with the use of big data and computers for artificial intelligence. And then finally, let me just mention a few things about autonomous vehicles or self-driving cars. There's a lot of talk and hype about this, but most people don't realize that for automated cars to work, the entire driving environment has to be mapped, not just in a two-dimensional way as on a traditional map, but in a three-dimensional way. Software has to be developed to deal with irregularities, with traffic signals that are out, with stop signs that are in disrepair. There's a problem with weather, snow covering up lane marker dividers. When we think about the real productivity payoff of driverless vehicles, we think of things like trucks and taxi drivers. But truck drivers are not just driving trucks. They're taking the things that are in the truck and delivering them at the other end of the voyage. We see truck drivers wheeling bread and beer into supermarkets and arranging them on shelves. And so even if the truck is driving itself, we'll still need the driver on to do this delivery task. So again, we're seeing lots and lots of innovation, but a lot of it is incremental, very evolutionary, not revolutionary, and it will take decades to make a real difference in how the world works.
So, Robert, as we move ahead and you see the use of robots become more prevalent, as artificial intelligence becomes more prevalent, what will be the impact, in your opinion, on labor markets?
I think there's a much too much fear that jobs are going away. The last 7 years has provided us ample evidence that there are plenty of jobs still waiting to be created. We've created in the United States 14 million new jobs, and the unemployment rate is down to 5%, something that is considered normal, about as low as the unemployment rate can go. We see jobs being created. The problem is that many of them are not very high-quality jobs. We're seeing jobs in fast food, in restaurants, in retailing, and there's been a hollowing out or diminishment of employment opportunities, both for blue-collar work in factories that have been decimated by Chinese and other imports and harmed by the incremental advance of machinery, we see the hollowing out as well as some kinds of white-collar middle-income occupations. I mentioned before language translation, not a huge occupation, but one that has been in competition with artificial intelligence. So overall, I think that the hype that all the jobs are going to disappear is greatly overblown. Every month, we seem to be able to create several hundred thousand new jobs. And so I'm very optimistic about the future of employment, with the caution that the jobs are not as high-quality or high-paying jobs as we would like to see.
Well, there's a lot more to talk about, but we are out of time. We thank you for joining us today, and would love to have you back.
Okay, nice to be here.
Well, joining me in the next segment will be Tom Pachauri. Tom is the publisher and editor of World Affairs Monthly. Tom has a very interesting and proprietary way of looking at history. And as I mentioned in the segment with Tom, it was Winston Churchill who said, if you want to understand the future, you need to look deeply into the past. And we'll do that with Tom in the next segment. And he'll make a rather bold prediction as to what might lie ahead. That's when Everything Financial Radio returns. Hope you'll stay with us. You are listening to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am Dennis Tubergen, your host. If you'd like to listen to any of the interviews that I do with our guest experts, you can visit the website, everythingfinancialradio.com, and listen to the interviews whenever you'd like, or re-listen to an interview that you hear on the program. You can also subscribe to the Everything Financial Radio podcast. All you have to do is visit the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio. You will then subscribe and get the Everything Financial Radio podcast as soon as it is released. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Tom Pochari. Tom is the founder and publisher and editor at worldaffairsmonthly.com. And Tom, welcome to the program.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure, Dennis.
Well, Tom, let's start by just telling the listeners about worldaffairsmonthly.com.
Okay. Well, you know, I guess it was, if I recall correctly, and that's a big if. No, I'm joking here. about 2002, spring of 2002, I decided I would, go on the net, so to speak, and publish a, I don't know what you want to call it, a journal of ideas, or, actually it was just meant to be a kind of a competitor to Foreign Affairs magazine, and I had planned to do that to more formally, but those people didn't really like me all that much, so I just went off on my own on the internet. And, I developed audio and video files. Probably, I think I was one of the first ones on the net to do that in the spring of 2003. And, everything was going pretty well until I discovered that the ruling establishment, was not really keen on developing all sorts of ideas. They kind of wanted their ideas developed. But I kept on, and, that's basically it. Then, of course, you have bloggers appearing on the net around 2006, and today, the net is pretty full of all sorts of ideas. If you're interested in them, you can go out there and find everything you want.
So you have, Tom, some interesting ideas on economics. And we chatted a bit before we started our interview here today, and I think you mentioned it was about 20 years ago that you looked at the science of economics, and you said you really can't help but laugh a bit when you look at that.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that?
Well, yeah, I think most people, in my work understand that there's soft science and hard science, and of course hard science is much more reputable. They don't laugh too much at that. Well, sometimes, but soft science, social sciences are fairly weak. And I was living in Washington D.C. with my wife, and I remember thinking about economic science from time to time, but it was around 1990, and I thought, well, really, this is lacking. This is seriously lacking. Maybe I should give it a try and see if I can't come up with, more powerful ideas to explain this thing we call, I would call it, wealth creation. Economic science is not really the right word to use. I think economic comes from the Roman word household management, which is fine, but I'm not sure it's really what we really want to say. So we're creating wealth, and just how do we do that? So then I discovered, to my amazement, as I looked at the history of science, that we would be able to not only understand the history of science pretty well, but get a science of history. And that's when I realized that, my goodness, I said, Tom, you can't just sit around and look at this for 5 minutes. You're going to have to look at this for many years. So it turned out to be a big job. But I realized that there really has to be a way to understand history from a scientific point of view, and develop so-called scientific ideas to explain this. And so to put it in a nutshell here for you, Dennis, I realized that there must be some phases of history here. And the human animal is on a very powerful trajectory compared to other animals. And the basis of this trajectory is the lowering of cost of information, the lowering of price of information from one brain to another, transmitting information from one brain to another. And I thought, my goodness, this is it. And I came up with this idea around April 2007. And then I discovered, really, that the pinnacle of what I call phase one of human history was
pretty much Roman, you know, Roman time, around 200 AD. And they started to move down in power and you know, everything they need to wealth creation. They started to move down around 200, and they fell apart in about 400 AD or something like that. And then a couple of years later, I realized, well, Tom, you gotta go further with this. And I discovered, decided that there are about three fundamental drivers or sources of economic development and growth. And I list them as number one, it would be energy for power, and number two would be not listed in any order of importance. Number two would be ideas or technology or knowledge for efficiency, and then the third would be the cycle for adaptation. And so I said, wow, that's pretty good. You know, I really like that. Then it was not immediately, but a couple of years later, I realized that those were not really the full picture. I had to go further, and I came up with three secondary sources. They would augment, they wouldn't be the important sources of growth, but they would augment the primary sources. And the secondary sources are commerce, you know, any kind of commerce, global commerce. And then, of course, we have debt business. And we have then the third would be central banking policy or just central banks. And I thought, my goodness, Tom, I think I've got something here, and I really like that. And then, of course, my immediate reaction was, well, if this works, it should predict the future, or I should be able to understand a lot of things. And, of course, good science means that you have a very few simple concepts and a vast explanatory power, you know, very, very powerful explanatory power. And that's what I figured I had. And since around 2011, Dennis, I have been kind of testing it. And I do have a research assistant, and he's really a shrewd guy, very, very clever. And he says, Tom, you don't really need to test it any further. It's really good. So he's very impressed with it. But I'm still looking at it. I tend to be on the paranoid side. I don't want to come up with anything that's inadequate, but it looks like it's working, Dennis. So anyway, I think that would be a good introduction. So, you ask away any questions you want.
Well, let's start with, there's three sources for economic growth. You said energy for power, knowledge or ideas for efficiency, and then a cycle for adaptation. So let's start with number one.
Sure.
Energy for power.
Right.
Give us an example.
Well, you could have, going back thousands of years, you could have the horse or the mule or human labor or the sun or, any kind of fire. You could have any kind of energy that you want. And, if you go many, many years back, you find that probably the best form of energy was maybe walking, moving around, human energy, and of course, working hard at whatever you're doing. And of course, later on, you develop other sources of energy like, coal or fire or steam or, whatever you think. Dennis, it's pretty obvious what energy is, right?
Right. So let's talk about ideas or knowledge for efficiency. Is that really just drilling down on that idea?
Yeah, I think so. I think, for example, I was just talking about, the walking. Well, somebody realized that what you're walking, with a horse or whatever, and you could have a wheel. So I think that's an idea that developed efficiency immediately. Obviously we use knowledge to gain efficiency. For example, I'm not an expert in agricultural technology, but around 1300 or 1400 AD, workers in the fields, or what you call peasants, obviously developed techniques to improve the efficiency of their farming. They were getting more output in their farming efforts than they were before because of certain techniques and ideas and technologies. So that would be efficiency. Whatever we can get more efficiency. For example, Dennis, you've got this photovoltaic panel, right? Everybody knows what that is. PV, they call it PV.
Well, yeah, the solar panels.
The efficiency of those panels is, I think I saw, it's roughly around 12%. So you're really only getting about 12% of the sun's energy, converting that to electricity. So you're really losing a lot of energy, and that is heat. And so your aim would be to get more efficiency.
And so far we failed to do that, and that's probably why, you know, solar energy is great, but it's not taken off like some people had hoped.
Cycle for adaptation. That's the last one here before the break. So
right.
I'm assuming, Tom, that is just assuming that it takes some people some time to embrace this refined idea.
Yeah, I think the cycle is pretty interesting. You know, you have the growth of the three fundamentals. The growth of the three fundamentals, very quick growth at per capita, meaning you're creating a lot of wealth, and pretty soon, you know, pretty soon you know that my goodness, your neighbors are doing better than you, and everybody's competing. The prices are going up across the board, and then suddenly you have a correction. And the correction is there for lots of reasons, I suppose, but I think the important reason is that, well, you know, some people are just not going to be able to compete. Some people are more efficient. Some people are got more ideas. Some people, you know, whatever. And you do have a correction, and, you know, the failures get left behind, and the winners go forward. So I think you're constantly overhauling the system to get more power, efficiency, and adaptation. And that seems to be what the cycle is.
It's a terrific place to end this segment. We will continue our conversation with Mr. Tom Pachauri in the next segment, and we'll drill down a bit and talk about some modern-day examples and what it might mean for you after Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I am Dennis Tubergen, your host. Thanks for listening in today. I'll be getting right back to my conversation with Tom Pachauri. But first, let me remind you, just in case you may be just tuning in, of a couple of free resources we have coming up and available during the month of June. We've got our Social Security Maximization Workshops. They begin at 6 p.m. and conclude at 7:30 p.m. with a complimentary dinner. We will be at Stonewater Country Club on Kalamazoo Avenue Southeast on Thursday, June the 16th. We'll be at Boulder Creek Golf Club in Belmont 2 weeks later on Thursday, June the 30th. We are getting terrific feedback on these events. And if you're between the ages of 55 and 69, I'd encourage you to go check it out at socialsecuritydinner.com. You can also register there. Socialsecuritydinner.com is the website. And then we have our new retirement rules class coming up on June the 25th. That's a Saturday. That class will be held from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at the East Beltline campus of Western Michigan University. You can get more information at newretirementrules.com. I have the pleasure of chatting today with Mr. Tom Pachauri. Tom is the publisher and editor at worldaffairsmonthly.com. In the last segment, Tom, we chatted a bit about these three sources for economic growth: energy for power, ideas or knowledge for efficiency, and then a cycle for adaptation. And you'd mentioned also that there are some related ideas. And one of the things that we talk about in this program a lot is central bank policy. And you mentioned that that's a bit related to this cycle or can affect the cycle. And I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but can you explain?
Yeah, well, you know, it's very interesting, Dennis, that when you have the takeoff of phase two, which is, you know, as I said, I think roughly around the 15th century, 14th, 15th century, you had about maybe two centuries of growth of those, you know, according to my model, so-called model, you have growth, really rapid growth in Europe and Western Europe. And then, of course, at some point, it seems the Europeans, the Swedish, I think the Swedish, the Dutch, I can't remember which one was first, but they understood that you need a bank, a central bank of some kind, you know, a national bank. And I think might have been the Swedes. I have to look it up on the Internet. That's what's great about the Internet. If I don't remember, you can look it up. But the British Bank, National Bank of Britain, or whatever you call it, was created, I think, in 1694. So, you know, roughly a couple hundred years later, you have this concept of central banking. And now the idea, I suppose, you know, if you go back in history, you realize that there is a lot of turbulence in the markets. And bankers were very afraid of runs on their banks. And I guess the British and the others in Europe there decided that, well, probably the way to go is to try to manage that system. And they would have a bank, central bank for all the banks. And, of course, when liquidity was needed, gosh, they provided it. So you see what I mean?
I've got it. So let's go to debt, which you also mentioned as a related topic. How does that tie in?
Well, I think debt is also pretty obvious, should be obvious, that, you know, you're doing business with somebody and you want to expand. Everybody's making money. And so Dennis realizes that, you know, his radio show is great, but he could borrow, you know, he could go to a creditor and say, you know, I need $100,000. I can expand my market. Before I know it, I'm going to be listening to, you know, I'll be listening to 300,000 people instead of 50 or whatever. And so you borrow money if you've got growth, and debt will augment the fundamental sources there of growth.
So, Tom, in the first segment we talked a bit, and you had said that one of the goals of this science of history was to predict what might happen in the future. And I think it was Winston Churchill that said, if you want to understand the future, you need to look deeply into the past. So that may be a related thought here.
That's right.
But tell me then, based on this science of history, what do you see lying ahead?
Well, you know, one morning I remember quite well, like I said, around 2007, I realized that I've been wrong for a long time. I thought America was quite powerful and strong. It would go on for centuries more. And then I realized, well, no, I don't think so. I think it's quite possible, in fact, highly likely, that we're going to see a complete collapse. And, you know, I may sound like a kook here, so you have to bear with me. We're going to see a complete collapse of civilization, Dennis. And that will be because we've lowered the cost of transmitting information from one brain to another. And we just have, you know, in the way these people in Silicon Valley here speak, you know, they talk about disruptive technologies. Well, we have the ultimate mother of all disruptive technologies called the Internet. And we're going to optimize that power of the Internet as well, you know, bring more power to it. So I think we're just looking at a very, very turbulent transition between what I call phase two, which we're in now, is the pinnacle. America represents the pinnacle, and Rome represented the pinnacle of phase one. We're moving into phase three, and the only question I have, Dennis, is how long does this take? And I wanted to mention that I don't, you know, there's a couple of unknowns here. I'm pretty certain of what the future is for us, but I'm not sure how long it's going to take and how deep it's going to go, this transition. So that, but do you follow what I'm saying there?
Yeah, let me maybe try to fill in maybe a gap that some of the listeners have here.
Sure.
And if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Mr. Tom Pachauri. Tom is the publisher and editor of worldaffairsmonthly.com. You had mentioned, Tom, that this coming collapse or extreme disruption, to use those terms, is as a result of the extremely low cost of transferring information from one brain to another. Can you maybe try to explain why that is?
Yeah, I think, like I said, Dennis, I think the idea is very easy to understand once you get a kind of like a good concept here. So many years ago, in the 90s, I would occasionally talk to Julian Simon, and he perhaps that name rings familiar to people in your audience, but he was a guy at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., a think tank guy, and he was in a battle with Paul Ehrlich. About prices of commodities, and they got into a you know, debate, and then they had a big I think they actually took a bet on it. They betted against each other, and so on and so forth. And you know, Simon was always arguing that the prices of commodities would keep falling. And of course, if you look at the prices of commodities in history, they have fallen. And I came up with this idea that well, they keep falling because we have more power, more efficiency, and more adaptation, and of course we can get everything cheaper, and of course that makes sense. Now, somewhere along the line, you bottom out, and it's I actually called it in the mid-90s. I called him in 1996, I remember, and we had a talk, and I told him, Julian, I think you're now going to be wrong. The prices of commodities are going to bottom out pretty soon, and then they're going to start rising. And this is all based on my model. I didn't really have it clearly in my head yet, but I was beginning to get it. And he was astonished. He was pretty angry at me, even though we got along just fine. But he was pretty upset. And sure enough, I was right, Dennis. We bottomed out in 99 or so, and commodity prices have been going up ever since. So the way to put it is this: we have to increase those three fundamental sources per capita. Now, if we can't, then we're going to fall down, you see. And so the choice is very simple. Either we get those moving up and get the secondary sources augmenting those, or we go down, and it looks like we're going down. So our power efficiency and adaptation is going down, and we've got too many people to feed, and, you know, we're in trouble.
So what does this – we've got about a minute and a half left, Tom, and I could talk for an entire program with you about this. But last question, when you say complete collapse, what does this look like?
Well, that's the big question, Dennis, because, if you look at the Dark Ages, you'll find that it really was a total collapse. Now, the problem we have with that period of history is we don't really know much about it because everybody was so poor and illiterate that we don't have any historical record. So, but you can imagine that the population declined very, very much, maybe even up to 80%. So I just fear that we're going to have a complete breakdown of human civilization, and of course the population will decline, and I, like I said, I don't know how much, but I fear it could be quite devastating.
So Tom, if somebody wants to learn more about what we're talking about, what would you have them do? What would you advise them to do?
Well, you can go to worldfairsmonthly.com, and of course I suppose you could email me if you want, or give me a call, and I'd be happy to talk to you. But I can't talk to 500 people a day, but I'd be happy to have some dialogue with your listeners or whatever and explain this. But I think there is, at worldaffairsmonthly.com, there is quite a bit of info there. You can probably, even without talking to me, you can probably figure out what I'm trying to say there.
Okay. Well, I'd encourage the listeners to check that out. And, Tom, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's about all the time we have for today. I want to thank all of you that have gone out and purchased the book, New Retirement Rules. It is an Amazon bestseller, and if you've not yet purchased it, we do have a special offer on a Kindle edition for about $1, and you can get it at Amazon. So just go to Amazon.com, search under New Retirement Rules, and you can pick up the book on Kindle for just $1. So for those of you that already have the book, thank you. If you don't yet have the book, I would encourage you to go to Amazon and pick it up for a limited time on Kindle for 99 cents. That's all the time we have for today. Hope you got something you can use. I'll be back again next week. Bye.